Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined today by Josh and Randy. Josh, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you, Sean?
Doing fantastic. For our audience, could you just do a brief introduction on your current role here at CIS?
Of course. My name is Joshua Paulsgreff, like Sean said. I am a senior cyber threat intelligence analyst, and I mainly deal with analyzing the data that the cyber threat intelligence team collects, as well as phishing and malware analysis.
Perfect. And one of our favorite guests, in fact, a co-host should be, I think Randy should be now officially a co-host, but Randy Rose, welcome back to the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
I'm going to take you up on that co-host thing, by the way.
Fantastic.
One of these days.
That's awesome. So, Randy, if they haven't seen one of your particular episodes, could you just briefly introduce your role to our audience?
Sure. I am privileged to be the Vice President of Security Ops and Intelligence here at CIS. So I'm mostly focused on the MSISAC mission, which is where we provide cybersecurity operational support to state, local, tribal, and territorial governments. So Josh's team, CTI, is part of that division. We also have our 24/7/365 Security Operations Center. We have a red team, and we also have a cyber incident response team, or CERT, which is the team that people call when they're in a crisis.
Fantastic. So we are back. Now, I don't know, Randy, is this our third or fourth annual scariest podcast in terms of malware for 2025? I think this is our fourth year doing this now.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, we're in definitely in like sequel past like second and third sequel territory. So yes. Let's just go with fourth.
Wonderful.
They always come back again.
Yeah,
this is territory
Friday the 13th part. Yeah. So this is our scariest podcast, fourth edition, again with Randy Rowe. So Randy, what makes malware truly scary in 2025? Stealth, scale, impact, something else. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'm hoping I didn't answer it this way in the past. I probably should have gone back and listened to what we said before, so I'm not repeating myself. But I think, you know, nowadays it's easy to focus on, and really for the last several years, it's been easy to focus on the events that are really big and loud. The ones that capture a lot of attention, they're flashy. Ransomware that, you know, is locking screens, locking people out of computers and demanding Bitcoin. But I think what's actually scarier today are the things that are quiet and patient, and, you know, that the stuff that hides in plain sight, the stuff that uses your own tools like admin tools against you, right? So the living off the land techniques, you know, the kind of malware that watches and waits. So to me, it's, you know, it's not really about what's noisy. It's about that, you know, it's about being patient, about that malware that can sit and wait, that's got all the time, right? And it's also not just the technical sophistication, I think, of a lot of these things, but the intent behind it. You know, just in the last couple of days, there was a major announcement from a security vendor, F5, that announced that there were nation state actors. I don't know if they assessed it or if it was Mandiant or another group that assessed it, likely associated with China, that had been in F5's development environment for a year, right? Those are the kinds of things that are I think are incredibly scary, especially in today's geopolitical environment. The intent of the attacker is the kind of thing that, you know, keeps me up at night. So less Leatherface, less chainsaw in the woods, and more Ghost in the Machine.
Nice. I love the references. We're really making that whole
thing. Try and pull them out.
So Josh, what, in your opinion, is making malware truly scary in 2025?
You know, for me, what makes malware truly scary in 2025 isn't necessarily just one thing, but a combination of multiple traits, whether it's stealth and, you know, malware hiding in plain sight to collect data or stage for something bigger, or spreading across environments or thousands of systems on a mass scale, or having, you know, huge impact like attacks on hospitals, critical infrastructure, affecting people's livelihood. I think the combination of multiple traits is what makes malware truly scary, because I think that what really sets today's malware apart from, you know, previous years is evolution. Malware is becoming more modular, polymorphic, and is constantly adapting to whatever defenses we put in place.
So, Randy, you know, we take that and then we think about the threat landscape, and Josh mentioned evolution. Have we seen that in the past year, that attackers are now better equipped? They've got this modular capability. They're able to either contextualize attacks for specific targets or create the Big Bang type of attacks, but utilizing different methodologies, different capability. Is that something you're seeing, or what are you seeing from the threat landscape this year?
Yeah, I mean, his word evolution is, I think, is spot on. You know, when I think of the threat landscape as a whole, right, you have this evolution on the technology side, but there's also this maturation of process on the people side. So, you know, really organizations are becoming more organized. We might even use the word something, you know, say they're becoming more corporatized with each passing year. I mean, they're really starting to act more like businesses. These are organized groups. It's hard to tell today. It's hard to tell the difference between a financially motivated criminal actor and, you know, a defense related or an espionage related state aligned actor. That the lines have become extremely, extremely blurred. And though it's hard to prove it with hard evidence, because we don't have a ton of insight into the actual planning process of the people behind these attacks, but it sure seems like attackers are becoming more strategic, right? Almost disciplined in the same way that Joshua and his fellow analysts on the cyber threat intelligence team are, right? The way that we think about cyber defense intelligence is very strategic in nature and very thoughtful and intentional. It feels like and seems like that same thing is happening on the threat actor side, right? They're using AI, they're using automation tools to scan and enumerate, map target environments. They're doing that at a scale that was, you know, really impossible until fairly recently. In some cases, they're fully automating some of their attack techniques, lateral movement and persistence. In some cases, they're able to leverage, like we see this a lot in the business email compromise space. Once they get access to an organization's email, they're taking that and replaying it using large language models to mimic the language of the people having the conversation via email. So it makes it much more difficult for defenders, and especially, you know, defenders that aren't necessarily, like I say defenders, but just, you know, average workers, to not get tricked by these kinds of things. Josh mentioned polymorphic malware, which makes a lot of our behavior-based detection mechanisms, you know, harder, but it becomes more critical than ever. I mean, IOCs, in some way, being indicators of compromise, where we look at a hash value of a piece of malware or some specific piece of evidence or artifact as a way to detect, is almost kind of becoming obsolete at this point because of polymorphic and modular malware. So, you know, yeah, I mean, the evolution of the technology is one thing. The maturity of the processes is another thing. The change in focus towards, I mentioned F5, you know, there's a lot of, they're one of many, but that change in focus on supply chain. So you go after one victim and, you know, you're hitting all of their customers. And that's a huge evolution over the last couple of years as well. So
agreed. Josh, any thoughts in that space that, you know, as you're seeing, interpreting this data, are you seeing in really what's changing in and how attackers are operating?
Yeah, I really like how Randy mentioned corporatization, because what initially pops into my mind is when I think about this, and it really goes hand in hand, is looking at dealing with a lot of cyber threat actors, and most of it being financially motivated and opportunistically targeting, that the description I would use is industrialized. We have ransomware as a service and malware as a service, which we've seen a couple years ago come into play, phishing as a service and initial access brokers, and even malicious traffic brokers like VexTrio. So that really means anyone can essentially rent malware or enterprise-grade attack tools. It's essentially democratization of cybercrime. And at the same time, these actors and groups, and in a sense, the malware and tools they create has gotten smarter, stealthier, modular, like I said previously, using living off the land techniques and capable of bypassing multi-factor authentication. For example, one phishing campaign CTI has tracked recently used Tycoon 2FA, a phishing as a service kit known for its adversary in the middle techniques that bypass multi-factor authentication. It uses realistic phishing lures, fake captchas, cloned login portals, and has strong anti-analysis features, showing just how sophisticated and even more accessible these tools have become to the larger population. The barrier for entry has never been lower.
Agreed. Well, if that doesn't scare based on the Halloween episode, I'm not sure what does, Josh. But Josh, what, in your opinion, what malware strain has now gained the title of most terrifying in 2025?
Well, for me, that would be LumaStealer. It's not overly loud, but it's pretty devastating. LumaStealer operates as a malware as a service. It's modular, constantly updated, and targets everything. Credentials, financial data, even cryptocurrency wallets. It's spread through almost every infection vector and helped pioneer tactics like using fake captchas, the click fix technique, which is new this year, and bypassing MFA, multi-factor authentication. It also packs multiple anti-analysis and defense evasion features, things like process hollowing, process injection, virtualization detection, evade signature-based detection, and even uses polygot files to slip past filters. I would say the scary part, though, is that even after it was taken down in May by law enforcement and Microsoft, by late June, it was back, almost like a zombie rising from the dead.
Wow. All right. So I'm sufficiently scared. Randy, anything to add to my fear with the title of most terrifying this year?
Yeah, so first, I do definitely agree with Josh on LumaStealer. Specifically for me, I would say the process hollowing piece that he mentioned is particularly nerve-wracking. So he kind of glossed over a little bit, but that ability to evade detection through process hollowing is actually really interesting. So just to kind of unpack it a little bit of what it is. It's able to effectively suspend a legitimate process. Then the reason it's called process hollowing is it quote unquote hollows out the memory dedicated to that process. So it's actually creating space in volatile memory in system running memory, then inserts its own code. I mean, that's like straight out of a horror movie in a way, right? I mean, it's like Alien or something. This thing is like ready to burst out of someone's chest. The system then runs this process, assuming that because it's still a legitimate process. So it just runs the code that's in the process, assuming it's trusted. So LumaStealer is then, whatever malicious code it had is running under this legitimate process. That's how it's able to do those EDR bypasses. So definitely terrifying. I would also say another one that name-wise actually really aligns with our theme here is SOC Ghoulish. It's got ghoul right in the name. In Q1 of 2025, it actually made our top 10 list of malware for the MSI stack, which, you can go to the cisecurity.org website and read our top 10 list that comes out each quarter. So it was one of our top 10 detections for Q1. And it actually represented basically half or pretty close to half of all the download detections that we saw that period. So we see it a lot. We see it over and over. Fake browser updates and compromised sites are, common source or SOC Ghoulish. But I think, it's a downloader by nature, so it can, help with downloading dangerous payloads. I think from a scary perspective, besides the name alone, when we see something a lot, we have a tendency to normalize it, right? To stop caring about it so much. And so this is a bit of, you know, the devil, you know, and we have a tendency to overlook it. We had the same thing a couple of years ago. I can't for the life of me remember the name, but I'm sure Josh remembers. But we had this like, it was popping up on school, higher education organizations a lot. And it was impacting Apple devices, but it was so prevalent, it just became noise in the background for a while. And to me, that's a bit scary, right? You stop caring about it until it's too late. Next thing you know, you find yourself in a horror film.
I believe you're talking about Schlayer.
Schlayer, yes. I knew it started with an S, but I couldn't Schlayer. Remember it. It was Schlayer, for sure. I knew you would know it.
That's what makes you guys such a good team. Fantastic. So, Randy, Josh had mentioned malware coming back from the dead. Anything in your mind that you've seen reemergence of either old threats with new twists or anything coming back from the dead in your mind?
Yeah, you know, I think one thing that we've learned, particularly with the way that we do data analysis here at CIS, that, you know, truthfully, malware doesn't die. It just reincarnates. It becomes an old, you know, it's just like a zombie film, right? It becomes repurposed. So we consistently see old code bases from Zeus and CACBOT, Emotet just reemerge under new names. We see the same thing with ransomware groups. A big one, ransomware group, I'll call them not necessarily a ransomware group, but a you know, an enterprise, criminal enterprise that we dealt with a lot was Black Cat in 2023 and 2024. They quote unquote formally disbanded, I think in early 2024. Josh, I'll have to correct me on that if I might have the timeline off a little bit, but they formally disbanded and just affiliates from them just pop up over and over again. And we see this happen over and over again. Every time the FBI takes or Interpol or whoever takes some group out, they just pop up with a new name, same MO, maybe a slight change to their technology stack. It's like, you know, it's like seeing horror movie villains pop up with better CGI and a new mask, but it's like, you know, the code evolves, but, and maybe the operators evolve, but it's the same over and over again.
Nice. So mentioning new technology, Josh, where are we seeing attackers utilizing generative AI? Is this simply just phishing and deep fake, or is it utilized in the space of malware development and building campaigns around that type of capability? Any thoughts there?
Yeah, so we've obviously seen and are continuing to see AI-written phishing emails that sound completely human, emails that read as if they were written by a native English speaker. That's the biggest area that we've seen generative AI being used to craft better phishing emails. But we've also seen synthetic voices mimicking executives, even deepfake videos impersonating leaders or relatives. I'm sure we've all seen a couple of these, as some of them have gone pretty viral, like that scam in Italy where the threat actor used AI to mimic the voice of the defense minister Guido Crosetto, I believe his name was, to call business leaders claiming urgent financial need. And I believe in that scam, nearly 1 million euro was transferred before it got shut down. I think with AI, creating AI-generated malware is in lab environments can work, but in the real world, it hasn't really come to, you know, into reality as of yet. I think right now it's with mostly just phishing emails that we have to be on the lookout for, because they're more ordinary. They are better, you know, better crafted than they have been with using generative AI. And it's made the scale of it increase, where how it's just so much more scalable now. An attacker can run thousands of convincing scams at once with the help of generative AI.
Yeah, I think, Sean, I think we talked about, I don't know, several months ago now, I came on the podcast and we actually were talking about Gen AI use in the threat actor community. I can't remember if I used this phrase on that, in that discussion, but I've come to use it at least since then, which is that, you know, of all the things that we see in the, you know, the use cases for Gen AI in the threat landscape, I would say it's kind of become the great equalizer for cyber criminals. And I think what Josh mentioned earlier is critical when it comes to that, the social engineering and Gen AI component, is that it has significantly lowered the bar, the barrier for entry, right? It's lowered the bar for basically anybody can get involved, because you know that it's a powerful tool. It's not that it's helped us make smarter malware or better code. It can do some things with code, but what it's done is it's created more capable criminals and capable con artists. And it's like, you know, it's kind of like giving a scammer, every scammer on earth, a PhD in persuasion, right? I mean, it's like, that's a powerful use case. And in English, I mean, it's able to translate for non-native English speakers. It's able to translate what they want to say into, you know, legitimate sounding, and sometimes sounding exactly like the person you want to emulate. That's crafting such an effective social engineering capability. I just was in last weekend was in Davenport, Iowa, for something called CornCon. That's a cybersecurity conference, a relatively small conference in Davenport, which got to give a shout out if there's any listeners in the Davenport area, the Quad Cities, what they call it, really happening town. It was my first time there. I was very pleasantly surprised at one, at how awesome the conference was, but two, how cool the city is. But I did a talk specifically on this. It was called Mental Malware, Inside the Supervillain Psychological Playbook, and it was developed in part with one of Josh's colleagues, Casey Cannon. And I talked specifically about that, right? And that, you know, I mentioned the business email compromise thing earlier, but you can literally take chunks of information about a person and run them through these LLMs and produce content that sounds exactly like that person. Imagine what that can do to somebody who has nefarious intentions. I mean, that's really a scary capability that we've equip people for, and it's you know, plays into manipulation 101.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back as I go cower in fear and have the courage to come back onto the episode and figure out what we're going to do about these types of threats. We'll be right back.
Are you a U.S. state, local, tribal, or territorial government?
If so, you know just how difficult cyber defense can get.
You're the frontline defense against cyber threats, yet you don't have the shiny tools, big budget, or skilled talent of an enterprise.
Well, guess what? You don't need them.
You do need a community of like-minded folks to unlock the power of collective cybersecurity.
And that's the superpower of the Multi-State Information Sharing and Analysis Center.
The Multi-State ISAC provides cyber underserved organizations with protections they otherwise couldn't afford at a price that works for them.
But it's more than just access to services. It's access to a community of peers where your participation protects them and theirs protects you.
Not to mention access to the 24/7/365 CIS Security Operations Center as your full-time public sector cybersecurity partner.
Available as a single organization or state or territory-wide option, the MSISAC membership provides threat intelligence, monitoring, and more to fortify your cyber defense.
Become a member today by visiting cisecurity.org/ms-isac.
All right, we're back. So Josh, help me get the courage to face these fears. What are the tools, the strategies that are proven most effective against these types of threats?
Well, unfortunately, there's no silver bullet, Sean. Most effective strategy is still defense in depth, guided by a threat-informed approach. That means aligning defenses with real-world adversary behavior, not just the checklist. The CIS critical security controls are a great foundation, and layering in purple teaming, threat hunting, and tabletop exercises will help keep defenses sharp and adaptive. It's also important to remember that although technology is critical, the human element matters just as much. A trained alert workforce is one of the strongest security layers you can have, and really training your employees and people on social engineering and the latest tactics will go a long way. Technology, EDR, antivirus can often detect and potentially stop attacks, but people can often prevent it because they'll be able to spot it.
Absolutely. So, Randy, now with organizations looking at these types of elements, where should they be adapting incident response playbooks, understanding the capabilities, as Josh has laid out, defense in depth? What's needed as we move into 2026?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question, right? Because I think a lot of organizations are probably lacking a playbook to begin with. But I think really the first thing organizations should do is first verify that they have some kind of, you know, playbook, a disaster recovery plan, business continuity plan. They understand what their crown jewels are, what they're trying to protect, who they're trying to protect. They have all that stuff figured out. If they don't, especially if they're a state or local government, they can reach out to us and we can help them with that. But Josh made the comment about, you know, it's more than just a checklist. And that's true. So even if you get to this playbook standpoint, you have a playbook, one of the problems I think a lot of organizations run into is they create a process or policy, playbook, whatever it is. And they create it once and it sits on the shelf and they don't test it. They don't go back to it until there is a crisis and they realize, oh, we haven't updated this thing in 5 years. All of these things are living documents, right? They it's one thing to have a checklist in there. That's fine. But they're really constantly evolving. And every, even little incidents, every little thing that you deal with, you should be going back to your playbooks and saying, have we updated this, right? Every time you have a major technology change, is the content within there still relevant? Every time there's a major organizational shift, whether it's, you know, reorganizing a part of the organization, or maybe your CIO moves on, or, you know, there's a new, emergency manager that's in the chain somewhere, right? All of these kinds of things are important, because probably one of the most important things actually in your incident response checklist or playbook is your contact list, right? Making sure that you know who to call under certain types of emergencies and crises. So just keeping that part up to date can be difficult with, you know, personnel movement and things like that. The other thing I think that's important that we haven't really talked about, cloud assets, software as a service, and those kinds of things. If we think about, in fact, I'm actually preparing to give a talk next week on what they're calling the fourth industrial revolution, right? Cybersecurity in the fourth industrial revolution. What does that even mean, right? This idea of fourth industrial revolution is this shift from just computer and automation-based technologies to fully integrated cyber physical and biotech and, right, these quantum, like all of these very advanced technological infrastructure types of deployments. And cloud falls into that. And more and more organizations, even under resource organizations and nonprofits, they're shifting into at least some aspects of their business into the cloud. A lot of them are using multi-factor solution, you know, multi-factor authentication. Some are using single sign-on solutions that are cloud-based. So as you think about incidents unfolding that are no longer, you know, on-prem, but aspects of it are in the cloud, now you end up with this kind of complicated situation. Who do you have to get a hold of that's not even in your organization? What vendors do you rely on? How quickly can you get a hold of them, right? So going through that process, and it's the worst time to figure that out, as everybody knows, is in the middle of a crisis. So you've got to kind of rehearse the chaos, right? Rehearse the situation, make sure that, you know, you have some kind of experience in dealing with what, you know, a situation when it's unclear, when the comms aren't quite figured out, when, you know, you have to get information out the door and you know, leadership's direction is messy, or folks are panicking, because that's what happens in real life. So you have to work through that process and practice it a couple times. It's you know, you don't want to be caught in the middle of you know, a situation where you're just, especially for under-resourced orgs, you just have nowhere to go, you know, nothing. Yeah, just no solution.
I liken it to, Randy, the playbook of, no, don't answer the phone. These are the horror movies, right? No, don't go into that house that's empty. Or
why are you going upstairs?
Exactly. Get out of there, right? But I think the scariest thing you mentioned is that organizations don't have an incident response playbook. That scares me. That's not good. We need to get that figured out and make sure that those are in play. All right, Randy, this is the penultimate question of our episode today, but if you had to name a malware after a classic horror character, what would it be?
So I've been thinking about this one a lot. I mean, if you're going to go for something that's truly scary, I think you have to go, and you said classic, you got to go with John Carpenter's The Thing, because you know, it hides inside you, right? It hides inside that from a malware perspective, it hides inside what you already trust, right? It's hiding in your network. It's hiding in your processes. Maybe it's hiding in your people, your staff. Maybe it's even inside you. You don't know, right? It destroys you from, it actually becomes you. It destroys you from the inside by becoming you. And I feel like a lot of, like, you know, from an analyst perspective, that's probably one of the worst nightmares. Like, oh, this thing's been in here in the network all along, right? That's what EDR is supposed to help defeat. So that's, I feel like that's the obvious one. But I'm also, more than horror films, I'm actually really into that, the campy horror, sillier stuff. Like, I'm a big Tim Burton fan, big Addams Family and Munsters fan. So I would actually probably, if it was truly up to me, I might go with something like Lurch, which is, one, a great name for malware. But I like the idea behind, like, you know, Lurch is this kind of slow and lumbering giant, right? He's quiet, only acts when he's summoned. And so you got this malware that, you know, just kind of lays dormant in the network until a specific C2 command, and then, you know, shows up, comes knocking, you know, you rang. Yeah. Anyway, it'd be fun. But yeah, I mean, you could do this all day long, right? I mean, think about it. Freddy Krueger, right? It's a malware that, you know, doesn't activate until you put the computer to sleep. Something like that.
Nice.
I don't know.
Nice.
I could do this all day.
Awesome. Brilliant. So, Josh, same question.
Yeah, I mean, Randy had some pretty good answers. And I think, similar to Lurch, I think a good answer would be the Shape after Michael Myers malware, specifically persistent malware today, silent, relentless, always coming back. It disappears, changes, and returns when you least expect it. But I think another name, and it's still classic, but not as classic as some of the others, would be Pennywise, like the clown from It. It lures victims in with something familiar, a red balloon, a memory, malware like an email from a colleague, a fake login page, a fixed access link, maybe even a voicemail. It's deceptive. It changes forms constantly. Phishing one day, a fake captcha, or a malicious ad the next. You think it's gone, but it's always going to come back waiting for the next victim. I think that really, you know, encompasses what we're seeing within the threat landscape today.
I feel like Pennywise is a good, like, social engineering.
Yeah.
One, too.
Yeah, that's totally exactly.
It's a lure.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, you say it, but it seems like IT as well.
Yeah, that's true. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. That's
good. Awesome.
Oh, how about you know, a malware for the modern day? I don't know if it's really modern day, but could have one like the Ring that spreads via, you know, TikTok videos and YouTube shorts, and then destroys all your stuff after 7 days.
7 days.
5 days. 7 days. 7 days. I think.
7 days. Yeah.
And yeah.
Bricks all your.
That's also good.
7 days after you watch a TikTok video, your stuff's just like bricked,
wiped. Yeah.
Well, I know what we're going to be doing next year for this episode, Randy. So we've already got this set up. We're going through characters and we're aligning them to malware tactics. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, Josh, Randy, again, great to have you on. Thank you so much for being part of our Halloween episode. And again, just great commentary, great feedback, and great work. I mean, all the work you're doing, truly transformative and really affecting many, many different people. So congratulations and really appreciate everything you do.
Yeah, as always, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks for having us on, Sean. Maybe I'll be invited back next year.
Yes, sir. Yes, you will. After this performance, no question. That was fantastic.
I can't wait.
Awesome. Awesome. And a thank you to our audience. We really appreciate your support. Subscribe in all the usual ways with your preferred podcast provider. Catch us on YouTube at TheCI Security. Questions, comments, concerns, podcast@cisecurity.org. And with that, we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.